And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
You've probably already weighed in on the comments of the religious rights poster girl, ultra-conservative Ann Coulter, who in her new book, Godless, The Church of Liberalism, refers to the widows of the 9/11 tragedy as broads, harpies, grief paparazzis, and witches who enjoy reveling in their husband's death. The airwaves are hot. It's got everyone talking. But in Darfur today, the slaughter of innocent people goes on, hacked down by raiders from the north, the Janjaweed, who just kill, rape, and plunder. Funny, I didn't hear any stories about the outrageousness of that. I must speak out, and today we do, as we delve into the Darfur Diaries, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Tomorrow night, I'm off to see Al Gore's blockbuster An Inconvenient Truth, which is getting strong reviews from almost everyone. It's amazing how the media can shape public perception. Suddenly, global warming is cool, or hot, or catching fire, or something. I give a lot of credit to Al Gore for having the nerve to become a celebrity, with all the glamour and pomp afforded the arrival of Angelina Jolie's baby, which has already earned over $4 million in his first week on Earth. There'll be plenty of detractors soon about Al Gore, not me. I get it. He's way smart. He's a true alpha male. He understands that right now, it all comes down to the media. As we've learned all too painfully, you can sell almost anything if you control the media. And there's a backside to this story, and that is that unless something can capture the media, no matter how awful or how grim, it will go unnoticed. That's our story today. It's the story of Darfur. Darfur is beginning to get at least a little airplay. And yet I think that most people really don't know what it's all about. After all, the story used to be called the Sudanese Civil War. But civil wars, particularly in Africa, are, well, civil wars. They happen. And in the past, in various areas of Africa, in short periods of time, we hear of 30,000 or 90,000 or 150,000 dead and 250,000 people hacked to death. And, well, for starters, since 2003, 400,000 people have been summarily killed and millions driven from their homes. The thousands of lost boys who wandered about the Sudan for years, hoping to find a place to be, boys 4 and 7 and 9 and 11, thousands who wandered. So today, while the media focuses on stupid Ann Coulter, it ignores the story of Darfur. We won't. We'll hear about Darfur from Adam Shapiro, who, along with his co-producers, documented just a bit of the story in their documentary, Darfur Diaries. This show is dedicated to the people of the Sudan and Darfur, some of whom I've gotten to know from my work with the Sudanese refugees here in San Diego. Forget about Ann Coulter. Turn your awareness and apply your thoughts to Darfur. We go in depth with the Darfur Diaries following the news. So now, the news. Floods in southern China are responsible for the deaths of at least 46 people as torrential rains and hail forced over 120,000 people to leave their flood-ravaged homes. China has a long-standing history of devastating summer rains and typhoons, which annually destroy homes, crops, and buildings. Last year, over 2,500 people died from natural disasters in China. Japan is threatening to pull out of the IWC, the International Whaling Commission, on complaints that the world body which regulates whaling for all member nations is unrealistic in its stand concerning whaling. The IWC banned all whaling in 1986, but Japan began taking whales for what it termed scientific reasons the following year. The IWC is opposed to whaling as they say it is a cruel abuse of the world's largest creatures. Japan, on the other hand, claims that the eating of whale meat is a long-standing cultural tradition, and that certain whale species can tolerate annual hunting. Japan says that unless the IWC lifts the ban, Japan will form its own whaling organization with other whaling-friendly nations. Japan currently takes whales for what it terms scientific research. Nevertheless, much of the scientific whaling catch ends up as whale products, despite the fact that the traditions of eating raw whale meat and blubber is quickly losing its flavor amongst younger Japanese who now prefer hamburgers. California's Governor Schwarzenegger declared a state of emergency in 10 Northern California counties whose salmon catch this year appears to be dismal. The $9.2 million appropriated will be provided as loans to help fishermen and communities recover from the hardships imposed by a severely restricted salmon season. Many fishermen are attempting to keep in business by heading north to catch Dungeness crabs, but the journey is economically dangerous with gasoline prices holding above $3 per gallon. The salmon run along the Klamath has been dramatically impacted by what some see as poor river management and dams in the Klamath Basin. Congress and the UN are each struggling to solve an alarming decline in ocean fish species caused by overfishing. Last month, the UN warned that action was needed to set limits on fish catches to turn the trends towards increasingly greater numbers of species considered overfished. Fully one-fourth of fish species are overfished, and another 50% are being fished close to their sustainable levels. Bills introduced in the House and Senate are making attempts at setting up 8 regional councils to oversee offshore fishing. Such councils could set 10-year regulations on catches within their domain. Unfortunately, the bills do not contain regulatory enforcement to truly limit annual catches from one year to the next to compensate for overfished species. And here's my favorite story of the day. The Honorable Chief of Fiji's Makuata Province relied on an ancient hunting chant to unite the island's chiefs to set up a 23-mile protected aquatic zone in traditional fishing areas. The chant, which means literally, "Let's paint the day red with blood," was historically used to unite allies in battle. Using this war cry, he was able to entice all the neighboring chiefs to hear what he was proposing. They came to realize that to create marine protected areas is the way forward, he said, because you preserve the fish not only for our generation, but also for those not yet born. At first, Fijians resisted the plan, which barred fishing in some traditional areas, but when fish began coming closer to shore, those fears were quickly washed away. To which I say, bula bula. And that's the news. A few reminders. A great show is coming up next week when we take flight with Southwings, a volunteer alliance of pilots that are bringing new perspectives on what we often cannot see. And we just may have a very special guest. That's next week. There is no more significant story in any news than the one we are going to feature on today's show. We're going in depth with a sensitive look and analysis of what is occurring in Darfur, which is part of a larger saga of the Sudan. Please take the time to listen to someone who has been there and who now offers his insights in this special edition of the Wildside News. The Wildside News focuses a lot on nature and the environment. The environment is a very broad concept, and we cover all sorts of different areas of that, from, you know, talking about frog behavior and animal intelligence. We also talk about energy independence and the global warming and the issue of the future energy wars that are certainly happening. And that's one of the reasons I thought today would be a great time to really take a look at something that personally I find one of the most disturbing realities that I've ever experienced in my life, And this has to do with the stories that we're beginning to hear about coming from the Sudan and Darfur. And joining us now is Adam Shapiro, who, along with Aisha Bain, is a co-producer of a film that is now being aired all across the United States, and it's called Darfur Diaries. Adam, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks for having me.
Adam, tell us about Darfur Diaries, about the film, and we'll go into more depth on that later, but what is it, and how long is it, and also kind of what's happening with Darfur Diaries right now, and then we'll get into the story.
Well, Darfur Diaries is about an hour-long documentary film in which audiences will have the opportunity to hear from Darfurians about their life both now during the conflict and their lives. Both, we interview people who are internally displaced inside Darfur as well as people who are refugees who are in refugee camps in neighboring Chad. We met people from all walks of life, people who are school teachers, people who are older people, people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s who've endured much more than just this most recent conflict in Darfur. We met people who are fighting with one of the rebel groups against the government of Sudan. And we met people who are just trying to survive and figure out a way to continue living in this land. The film is now being shown, as you mentioned, across the United States at universities and community centers and wherever we can organize screenings. And what we hope to do with the film is inject into the public consciousness in this country and in the West more broadly the voices of the people who themselves are experiencing what some have called genocide and what certainly by any stretch of the imagination is some of the most extreme trauma that anybody can imagine.
Let's talk about why some people are beginning to awaken to the fact, some of us earlier than others, about why we consider this a genocide of our era, of our time.
Well, I think there's two components to it. There's one component, which is why has it taken so long for people to recognize this and to act on it, or why there has been a lack of action, particularly in light of, after our experience of Rwanda about, now more than a decade ago. And then the second aspect of it is all of the politics around calling this genocide, or calling anything genocide for that matter. On the first point, in terms of why it has taken so long, I think one of the reasons is that Darfur is an extremely remote area. It is, having been there and been in a number of different parts of northern Darfur, I can tell you that there isn't a whole lot of information technology, infrastructure, anything like that, where it would be easy for people to get word out. And so for a while, the only way people knew something was happening is because there were people streaming across the border from Darfur into Chad, and inside Chad, it took the response there by local communities to alert local officials, who then alerted the United Nations that something was going on and that, you know, refugees were arriving in Chad and needed assistance. There's the whole information side of it. And then secondly, the world has certainly been distracted the United States has been distracted over the last few years by what is going on in Iraq, what the U.S. is doing in that country, and other developments in other parts of the world that perhaps are touching more on America's interests certainly involving American lives in the case of Iraq. And Darfur and Sudan is sort of a far-off place. And then finally, I would say that most of the news that had come out of Sudan over the last two decades, and certainly in 2000, 2001, up until 2003, had to do with the North-South Civil War in Sudan, the end to which was brought about by a negotiated peace agreement that was signed in 2003, in which the U.S. administration actually played a very important role in bringing about. And so many people sort of were confused. Well, there was a civil war, and it seemed to be this peace process that was underway. So how does Darfur fit into all of that? Does it fit into all of that? Is it not the same exact thing? Is it something different? And so there was a lot of confusion around that. As to the issue of genocide and whether it is or isn't, or how to debate it, whatnot, certainly I think that we can clearly identify a group of people in Darfur who have lost, who have been attacked, who have lost their ability to live in a particular area by virtue of this coordinated planned attack that is certainly being organized by a government. And so, you know, I think it certainly would qualify in terms of calling it a genocide. However, the groups, the parties that have called it a genocide to date, including the U.S. Congress and the U.S. administration, when former Secretary of State Colin Powell called it a genocide, they have failed to act. So when Congress passed a resolution calling the crisis in Darfur a genocide, it passed a non-binding resolution, which meant that it was just a statement. There was no action implied by that statement. Additionally, the U.S. administration hasn't felt bound at all by its declaration of this conflict as a genocide in terms of its dealing with the government of Sudan, and so subsequent to its declaration, to Secretary of State Powell's declaration of the genocide, the U.S. went on to host the top Sudanese intelligence official here in the United States for consultations about the war on terror, and didn't bother to mention at all what was brewing in Darfur and what the U.S. felt about it. So there's an element of politics involved here that has made it so far very easy for certain parties to call this a genocide without actually doing anything about it.
You know, actually, definitions only serve actually a limited purpose, because the story really is, it has to do with human beings. And the thing that troubles me in the story about Sudan and Darfur is that when civil war was unleashed and things began to get very intense, which began in 2003, the real truth of the matter is that 400,000 people since 2003 are dead as a result of absolutely willful, wanton, brutal slayings, primarily coming from the north, and we'll talk about that. And then in the process of having this slaughter, orchestrated slaughter, perpetrated on the people of southern Sudan, people have just fled for their lives, literally for their lives, with absolutely nothing on their backs, just to try to survive. So the numbers that have been pouring into the refugee camps since 2003, estimates are close to 2 million people. This is a huge, huge human tragedy. And I personally can't understand how this could slip below the radar. I can't find any justification. I'm not challenging what you said, but just as a person and a U.S. citizen, it's extremely difficult for me to understand how this could so slip off the radar screen from the perspective of media, people in Congress, leadership, and it just hasn't been discussed at all. So if you could talk about, you know, you and there's a player in this, the co-director, Aisha Bain, who was a deputy director for the Center for the Prevention of Genocide, and she began to kind of tap into the story and began to try to get people to pay attention, and she ran across some sort of, I don't know if it was a brick wall or deaf ears or what the conflict was there, and this began to bother her. and somehow she expressed this to you, and you guys came up with an idea. We'll find out what happened to that good idea when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.